Hello, everybody. This is Salil Tripathi from the Institute for Human Rights and Business with Richard Bull, who is from KPMG, the international accounting firm. But he has a very interesting background. He has been a champion of human rights. He has worked for the struggle of freedom of the Ogoni people. He has been involved with that, and he has worked on the business and human rights agenda for an extremely long time.
It feels far too long at times.
Well, yes, that's true. But he is in a very interesting and exciting new position at KPMG in Australia to lead their human rights practice. So, first of all, Richard, congratulations. My first question is, what does it mean? What is an international auditing and accounting firm doing with human rights, and what role do you play there?
Well, let me first just take that congratulations, say thank you.
Yes.
When the acquisition first happened, I had many congratulations, you know, well done. And there was a real element of, you know, personal achievement and acknowledging that. And I said, well, no, I think it's much more interesting as a signal in terms of what is happening in mainstream business when an international accounting firm like KPMG not only acquires a business like mine, which was Bonara, but actually gives me the title Partner Human Rights and Social Impact. So to me, it's much more exciting as a question mark about, well, what is now happening in terms of mainstreaming of business and human rights. What, to answer the second part of your question, so if I could just deal with that, thank you.
But I'd
much prefer to characterise it as an interesting question around what's happening now. I think the second part, I've been given the opportunity to build a practice around human rights and providing human rights advice to business in the Australian context. I'm very fortunate to be a partner because that gives me all sorts of latitude and permission to explore what I think interesting or particularly what are prospective areas around providing advice to particularly business on human rights. But I'm also very interested in seeing what the global opportunities are.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, just to kind of lay it out, I think it was within 2 weeks of joining, I went and saw the chairman of KPMG Australia, and I said, you know, thank you very much. It's fantastic to join KPMG Australia. Now, let me talk to you about where I like to be when I retire. And of course, he immediately looked at me and said, well, hang on, you've been here 2 weeks. Why are we already talking about retirement? I said, well, my goal is really clear. You know, as you kindly introduced me and acknowledged, I guess, that activist background, going forward, I'm still got an activist ambition around wanting to see respect for human rights mainstreamed into business. Now, I think I've now got an opportunity to contribute to that by positioning KPMG within 8 years as the global leader around advising business on how to be responsible in relation to human rights or how to respect human rights. So I guess it's that win-win. Will I be successful in that project? I have no idea, to be honest with you. I was particularly interested to see, you know, the mainstream conservative business press give extensive coverage to mm-hmm. the acquisition. And I guess mm-hmm. that's another signal about, are we at an interesting time? Are we at a bit of a crossroads around?
So would you say that the whole agenda shifted from one of reputation management to risk assessment and risk impact management to mitigate the risks? Because if we look back 20 years, mm-hmm. human rights was really seen as something that has happened to the company and therefore the need for a public relations response to it. So you engage Amnesty, you engage Human Rights Watch and have a good story out. But it seems to me that if KPMG invests in it and you have worked on it for so long, it seems companies that want to actually start changing their behavioral practices so that this doesn't happen again.
I think that's exactly right. KPMG, it's not a philanthropic, kind-hearted in that sense. What they've definitely seen is enough of their clients start asking questions around human mm-hmm. rights risk, business risk, and there's no question. You know, we sit within the risk consulting part of the business, so I think that provides an insight as well
mm-hmm.
in terms of what they're hearing from, or they're hearing now what we're hearing. I need to get used to the fact that it's now we. Now, what we're hearing from our clients around this agenda and what is that, I guess, that framing conversation. It is definitely a risk conversation. I still think the consequence, though, is largely brand damage or reputational damage. However, if you're looking at things like particularly the supply chain, because largely, you know, the two areas of work we have, one is those host communities.
And what extractors.
Yeah, extractors. What are the impacts on those communities that, that represent, you know, human rights risks to rights holders? And then there's supply chain. And what's been fascinating in the Australian context in the last 18 months is a real public narrative shift from human rights risk to right holders in supply chain developing or producing products to services. So we've had a lot of stories around cleaners, trolley collectors, fruit and fresh food pickers, all these types of low-skill or no-skill services where Australian companies are increasingly finding themselves surprised by unacceptable, I mean totally unacceptable practices within their supply chain in service provision.
And you so there's a lot of room for change and improvement.
There's no question. I mean, yes. I was at the CEDEX conference speaking yesterday, and I managed to elicit a gasp from the 500 people in the room. And what I was talking about was the Cleaning Accountability Framework, which is a multi-sector stakeholder initiative to address the worst forms of labour practices within the cleaning sector. It has building owners, it has building managers, it has the union, United Voice, it has the regulator, Fair Work Ombudsman, and it has cleaners and cleaning representative companies all sitting around the table and building trust for 3 years now. And we're finally going to start piloting from the 1st of July. Now, the idea is you'll be able to walk into a CBD building in Sydney, Melbourne, around Australia, and it will be in the future certified 3, 4, or 5 stars in terms of the labour practices that the people who are cleaning that building are experiencing. Right. Now, take this away. 3 stars will be that those labour practices that are delivering cleaning services in that building comply with the law. Now, what are we talking about when we're talking about a developed country where a voluntary certification scheme starts at communicating to the general public that when you walk into this building, the cleaners are being treated in a way that's compliant with the law? So that, I think, is a very clear signal of how deep the systemic issues have become around labour practices within that particular sector. And look, why would be a good question. And I think it's quite complex, but certainly one of the major reasons is you know, cleaning is seen as something that is no skill, and it's certainly been experiencing significant downward cost pressure as deflation on so many. We talk about t-shirts that cost $5, you know, £2, you know, the £2 t-shirt. Now, how do we ultimately produce something continually cheaper like a t-shirt or provide a service like cleaning and that gets cheaper and cheaper and cheaper? I think ultimately you cross a line and there's such significant externalities that it then gets cheaper because someone is paying a very personal cost in terms of their enjoyment of their
which is the story of Bangladesh in a way. You know, the price of the t-shirt, there's been a good book about it, or that topic too. And there has been an opera done in Germany about that as well, which actually points out exactly that what is the true cost of the t-shirt. And when the building collapsed, Muhammad Yunus actually talked about having a t-shirt tax.
Right.
That every consumer agrees to pay 50 cents more, which directly goes for the workers and so on. So yes, I mean, that is going to, and that verification is going to be important, which brings me to the whole issue of measurement.
Yeah.
That can human rights performance ever be truly measured? Or what can you measure? Can you measure processes and their effectiveness or outcomes? And if we do measure outcomes, what is the link with the company's own action?
Very good questions. Our experience to date has been primarily in the extractives, and there is no question we can take an approach to measuring change. And I think our colleagues within the development sector for 20 years have been looking at log frame, you know, conceptual approaches such as theory of change, which says, look, we would like to undertake some interventions within this community, within this context, with a view to improving human rights outcomes. Yeah? So whether that's livelihoods or whether that's health or whether that's education, I think that's conceptually an approach that's been well recognised for a long time. Now, what has not been is companies asking themselves, can we measure the effectiveness of our interventions? And they're often voluntary. Mm-hmm. You know, in particular, I think extractives have been very good at doing that for a long time, is recognizing that equitable share of benefits of the development of that operation is not something that you can always rely on government yes. to deliver, right? Mm-hmm. So if they're going to have that social license within that context, they need to actually undertake voluntary community development programs that then allow a broader enjoyment of the benefits of that operation being there. And I'd say only in the last half decade, maybe a little bit longer for some leaders, are those community development measurement disciplines being brought in. Now, can we see a day where we might start looking to use those same measurement approaches mm-hmm. in the supply chain?
Yes.
I'd have to ask the question, why not?
Yes.
But who would have the appetite when supply chain is already so tight in terms Overtly of resources? Edited,
yes.
yes. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
It's possible, but we just have to ask ourselves when and who will have that appetite.
That's right.
But it is possible.
Yes.
So I think the answer very simply is yes, we can put a baseline in, and we can, with a community of people, a community of rights holders, if we want to call them that, we can over a period of time measure and observe key indicators that tell us to what extent are they enjoying and to what extent is there a change in their enjoyment of certain human rights.
So, you know, what I've learned from this is that you'll have to postpone your retirement.
You think it's going to take longer.
Absolutely. But wonderful talking to you. Thank you so much, and all the very best to all you do.
Thank you, Cyril.
Thank you.